This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're about to listen to a brand new series of Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley. New episodes will be released weekly wherever you get your podcasts, but if you're in the UK, you can listen to the latest episodes a week early, first on BBC Sounds.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Join us as we travel back in time and across the world, tailing scammers, crooks, con women and convicts, women from all walks of life who found themselves on the wrong side of the law. What do their lives and their crimes tell us about women in the past? And how different is it for women today? Our case today has everything you want from a sensational Victorian melodrama. In fact, it has so many twists and turns that you might need to grab a piece of paper and a pen and start making some notes. Who is our serial swindler and star of our show? I'll let her introduce herself.
I am Annie Newbond, Anne Bruce Sutherland, Annie Ogilvy Bruce, Madame Le Baron de Bowman Stewart. I'm Mrs. Annie Ogilvy White. Annie Frost, I am Mrs. Annie Gordon Bailey.
Whoa, that is quite a list, because our Lady Swindler has over 40 aliases. I think we'll just go along with the last one, Mrs. Annie Gordon Bailey. She was a very charming con artist, a fraudulent fundraiser, and a woman who didn't believe in paying her bills. She conned everyone from the milkman to government ministers. Oh, and for a while she had a wealthy benefactor and was married to an opera singer. This is the stuff of which biopics are made.
Who she was, nobody could tell. That she was a personage of some importance was taken for granted. There was much mystery. And absolutely no data to go on as to this woman's personality.
The prisoner is an extraordinary woman, one of the greatest swindlers in the country.
I verily believe she would deceive the devil himself.
I am thrilled to be joined by someone who enjoys a good mystery as much as I do. She writes historical fiction, crime fiction, and graphic novels. And she's no stranger to the Lady Swindler studio. It's Denise Miner. Hello, Denise.
Hello, Lucy.
Welcome back. Now, let's get into this. Annie is born into poverty in Peterhead, a fishing village on the east coast of Scotland, in February 1848. She's illegitimate, illiterate, and by her 20s, she's defrauding shopkeepers. She's not paying the bills she runs up. Are you ready for this, Denise?
I'm thirsty for it.
Are you tempted by what you've heard so far?
I'm as thirsty as a milkman with infinite credit who's banging on the door to find out what she's about.
Brilliant. I love it. She's also passing herself off as a young, pretty Christian woman involved in charitable deeds. In the early 1870s, she starts fundraising to set up a Protestant girls' school in Rome. She's given plenty of donations, even spends time in Italy, but the school never materialises. In October 1872, the law briefly catches up with her. She spends 9 months in prison for fraud. When she gets out, she snares herself a wealthy benefactor, Sir Richard Duckworth King. More about him later. Then she goes to London, marries an opera singer called Knight Aston. They have 3 children and spend some time in New York. Are you keeping up with this, Denise?
I am. Isn't it interesting that she's identified something that people are very angry about, there not being a Protestant school for girls in Rome, which is a very Catholic city. She's so wily. You know, she's absolutely fearless for somebody who comes from nothing. And it makes me think that maybe she believes the lies she's telling.
Intriguing. Annie Gordon Bailey is still defrauding countless shopkeepers and tradesmen, but she's actually building up to something even bigger and more lucrative, a really ambitious swindle. On the 24th of November 1884, she turns up on the Isle of Skye, off the northwest coast of Scotland, wearing fancy clothes and jewels. She passes herself off as a wealthy literary lady who's writing a novel about the plight of the crofters of Skye. Now, a crofter is someone who lives and works on a small farm, a croft in Scotland. They might grow crops, raise livestock, or fish. At this time, the crofters are at war with the wealthy landowners who want to throw them off the land. There have been skirmishes and protests, and things are getting very heated. Annie's interviewed in the capital, Portree, by the Aberdeen Evening News.
I have come from London to see the crofters in their homes. I am sincerely sorry for them, and I'd do anything in my power to help them. Although I belong to and have been reared among the aristocracy, my sympathies are not with them. I think they have been guilty in too many cases of very great injustice.
Let's not forget that Annie Gordon Bailey is no more an aristocrat than you or me. Oh, actually, Denise, you're a dame, aren't you?
I'm here shining up my fraudulent damehood. I started claiming to have a damehood as a joke, and lots of people believe it, so much so that I started getting abuse online for having accepted a damehood, which is the ultimate mark of authenticity.
Well, you're in the true aristocracy, the aristocracy of literature. That is for sure. So let's find out what Annie was doing on Skye and what life was like there for the crofters. Catherine McPhee is an archivist at the Skye and Lochalsh Archive Centre in Portree, and she has an ancestral link to our story. She is related to John McPherson, sometimes called the Glendale Martyr. He was imprisoned twice for his role in these crofter rebellions, and he became a leader of the crofters' cause. So, Catherine, the crofter's story is literally in your blood.
So I'm the three times removed cousin of John McPherson. I'm also the three times removed cousin of Neil MacLeod, who is the famous bard in Glendale. So John was a land activist and Neil was quite a radical land reform poet. So something really interesting to research, but also something to be really proud of.
That's an amazing heritage. For people who'd never been to Skye or even to Scotland, can you describe what crofting life was like?
It was marked by poverty, hard labour, and there was a constant struggle to maintain their land and livelihoods. We grew just enough food to feed our families with little surplus. Crop failures could lead to other levels of hardship. And their houses, these stone-built, kind of very simple croft houses, the roofs were made from wood and heather or turf, and quite often cold and damp, particularly in these long winters that we have here.
And why were the landlords trying to clear the crofters away?
It was a very violent period. It was economic. For them, it was let's clear the people out and put large-scale sheep farming in. Also, by displacing people and moving them to colonies in Australia, America, Canada, that created a workforce for what the British were doing there. They were forced to leave these ancestral lands. That left quite a mark on Highland culture.
Annie Gordon Bailey arrives in Skye in November. What's the island like at that time of year?
Skye gives this really cruel but beautiful visual look to it. It can be really cold and crisp, but in November 1884, amidst that cold, there was that stillness and we were just about to be surrounded by gunships. There had been widespread revolt by impoverished crofters. There had been several violent clashes with government officials and police. And then in February 1882, John McPherson held a public meeting in Glendale to set up the Land League. And this was a turning point in the fates of the crofting community. So by 1884, we had over 340 military men arrive in Skye, authorised by the government in that November. So it was really an army coming.
So the island was at boiling point just at the point that Annie arrives. What do you think that these crofters made of Annie when she turns up?
I mean, it wasn't the first time somebody had come to exploit us and use our story for their own gains. The Crofters were quite clever. They used the journalists and they used these stories as a way to keep their stories getting out so the wider country could hear about what was going on. So they probably would have thought, this is good press. And if she's got money, she can back the Land League. She can support what we're doing.
I don't like to think what they may have been secretly thinking about her turning up in her fancy clothes on their islands. There must have been such a culture clash there. Denise, Annie is raising money for these Crofters, but not giving it to them.
It's so interesting that she's got such a great eye for an emotive cause. She's going to be raising money to save these people. And the grandiosity of it as well. She's not hiding. Anyone who's ever come across her, she owes them money. But she's up there and she says, I'm going to solve this problem. She's very self-serving for someone so light-fingered.
She's passing herself off as a lady novelist. Is that an identity that you ever inhabit? What does that mean, a lady novelist?
Everyone I know who's a woman writer would never claim to be a lady novelist. A lady novelist to me is someone who wants a lot of attention, wants a lot of emotional engagement. It's a romantic position to adopt. I think she goes there with a very distinct purpose in mind, which is she's going to raise money and leg it with the Dosh.
I know what you mean about lady novelist. 100 years ago, I imagine it was a way of passing yourself off as an unacceptable thing, which was a working woman. Oh, I'm a lady. I'm above the sordid business of money. But actually, that might be the way somebody made their living. So I'm giving her a bit more slack than you are at this point. Now, what about this business of the names? She's got so many names. What would you call yourself if you needed to use an alias?
Well, I was going to call myself Penny Dreadful when I started writing. I thought that would be a great name.
Penny Dreadful, that's brilliant. Why didn't you?
Isn't that great? What a great name. And then my friend said, well, you might only have one book published and you not want it in your own name. So I had to forgo that alias.
If Annie were going to be a character in one of your books, how would you go about constructing her? Or would you say, no, this is just unbelievable. This is going too far. Nobody will believe this woman.
It's so believable. If you know anything about con artists, she is a very particular type. I mean, physically, how would I describe her? She is very pretty. She's very petite. She's always well turned out. She's taking money that should be going to Crofters, who are just about to go to war because they're being run off their land and burnt out of their homes. So she's quite spiteful in what she's doing, but it's all wrapped up in this lady facade.
Let's bring in our in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone. Hi, Ros.
Hello, Lucy. And hello, Denise.
Hi, Ros.
What an extraordinary case. One, I think, that despite the attention that it grabbed at the time, was really largely forgotten. But recently it has come to wider attention again, thanks to the work of Mick Davis and David Lasman, who have written a book on this case called The Adventures of a Victorian Con Woman. And they have really gone to town with their detective skills in order to drag up all the twists and turns. We're really going to use this case as a springlock to reveal female criminality in the 19th century.
Well, it seems that Annie Gordon Bailey is acting according to the pattern book for a wealthy socialite at the time that involves giving to charity and presenting yourself as a philanthropist. Is that right?
Yes, the Victorians were great philanthropists. And this was partly a consequence of the evangelical spirit of the age, but there was also a genuine desire to help the needy. And the state relied on charitable giving to fill the gaps where they weren't providing for people through social policy. We see the proliferation at this time of charitable businesses like Barnardo's and the Salvation Army. Philanthropy was also especially important to women because it was a way in which respectable middle-class women could have something like a career.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vitor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
And it's also crucial to note that the charity sector at this time was not strictly regulated. There was no specific law against fraudulent fundraising. That didn't come in until 1916.
Very interesting. Now, back to the story. A correspondent for the Aberdeen Evening News meets Annie for a coffee in a hotel in Portree, and he seems rather taken with her.
A crimson dressing gown, red silk stockings, and natty high-heeled shoes with silver buckles. The fourth and fifth fingers were encrusted with jewelled rings, the gems of which sparkled and gleamed in the firelight.
That sounds expensive. Roz, how is she bankrolling her travels in this sort of luxury lifestyle?
Well, until now, she has had this wealthy benefactor, a man called Sir Richard Duckworth King, the third baronet and former army officer. And he would have probably been in his 60s when they first met. Now, Mick Davis and David Lasman estimate that Annie managed to burn her way through about £18,000 of his money, which is about the equivalent of £2 million today. But at this point, King's money has virtually dried up, and he's also been declared senile. So her cash cow is no longer available. And to make the big bucks, she really needs to look elsewhere.
And Roz, while she's here on Sky, there's the beginning of a love story, isn't there?
That's right. She meets another campaigner, a man called Robert Percival, or Percy, as he's known to his friends, Percy Frost, the son of a clergyman, and also at this point, a committed Christian socialist. And this is what motivated him to travel up to Skye. He's also 10 years younger than Annie. So she's also a cougar.
Well, he was irresistible because he wore a pink tam o'shanter.
He also had a very large moustache.
Percy Frost and his huge moustache. Back to the story. Annie's now in London, and Percy moves in with her and her three children. But the relatives of Richard Duckworth King, the benefactor, aren't happy about all of his money having disappeared. They start asking questions, they alert the police. It's time for Annie to do a disappearing act. She comes up with an audacious scheme to help the Crofters of Skye. She wants them to emigrate, and she thinks that she can find land for them to live on in New Zealand. It turns out, though, that she can't charm the New Zealanders, so she heads to Melbourne, Australia. She sets her sights on a piece of marshland on the coast at Wilson's Promontory in Melbourne, and she plans to transport up to 1,000 crofters there. They'll be assigned 50 acres each and will become fishermen.
Melbourne Weekly, 23rd of July, 1887. A colony of crofters. Mrs. Gordon Bailey's scheme.
She gives an impassioned interview to the Melbourne Telegraph.
Do you think the crofters want charity? They're the most hard-working men you can find. Go amongst your unemployed, and if you find a Highlander with them, I'll eat them. If the crofters come, they will be a benefit to the colony.
Denise, it's incredible to me that she can even begin to put this super complicated scheme on the other side of the world into action. Do you think that she's really thought this through?
But the whole point is the crofters don't want to leave. That is the whole dispute. I mean, it is like offering, you know, somewhere in South America to the people of Palestine. I think she's doing what psychopaths do, which is suggesting something, seeing if it registers on somebody's face. And then, you know, everybody in Melbourne wants this awful marshland off their hands. So that's selling over there. But I don't think there's any real kind of theory at the back of it.
Like a comedian testing out their material. And when people laugh, those are the jokes they tell next time, kind of thing.
That's right. And if they don't, they just rip that page out and put it in the bin.
Interesting. Denise, does this idea of a fraudulent fundraiser strike any contemporary echoes for you?
I mean, it makes me think of Belle Gibson, who was a very big name in the wellness space. She claimed she'd had cancer and got a lot of sympathy. She was raising money for other people's cancer treatments. She made an absolute fortune. And it's still happening today. It's not an uncommon thing.
We think of charity as a really good thing, and we all want to give a bit. but there are some people who are really willing to take advantage of that.
Anyway, let's move on. Annie gets in front of some very prominent politicians, including the Premier of Tasmania. But it's discovered that the land she wants for the Crofters is of very poor quality. There's also opposition from the fishermen of Melbourne. And of course, there's no evidence that the Crofters want to leave their homeland anyway. Plus, Annie's being sued by the milkman for unpaid bills. It is time to skedaddle. Annie and her family return by ocean liner to London, having been away for more than a year.
While Annie is travelling back to the UK, we have come to Scotland Yard. Now, you might have seen New Scotland Yard on the news. That's the police HQ today. But we've come around the corner to the original Scotland Yard. And I can see a blue plaque here, which says that the Metropolitan Police were based here from 1829 to 1890. This is the base of Annie's nemesis. Yes, he's called Detective Inspector Henry Marshall of the Met. In early 1888, he's made aware of a prolific lady swindler who's been conning small businesses all over London. Roz, what can you tell me about this D.I. Henry Marshall?
Henry Marshall was the son of a gardener, and he was originally apprenticed as a shoemaker. But instead, age 20, he joined the Metropolitan Police. That was in 1869. And by the early 1870s, he had risen up the ranks and become a detective.
So tell me how Annie gets away with it for so long, defrauding this whole string of shopkeepers.
For centuries, wealthy people had purchased goods on credit. They would promise to pay shopkeepers and tradesmen at a later date, and they'd often accumulate these really big debts before they sold
them. Just put it on my account, that sort of thing.
That's right. Now, in the 19th century, rising real wages and the retail revolution meant that personal credit was extended to more and more people. You just needed to look respectable and have a respectable address. But were these unpaid debts bad debts, so there was an original intention to pay, but now the person couldn't? Or were these criminal frauds, that there was never an intention to pay in the first place? And this could be really hard to prove. So many of Annie's frauds are really petty, and they don't attract immediate attention. Also, she's a woman, and the popular stereotype of a fraudster was male. Now, in this case, over time, Annie's persistence and her exhibitionism did begin to attract attention.
So how is Detective Inspector Marshall going to get his evidence to convict her?
So in January 1888, she gives an interview to the Pall Mall Gazette on her Crofter scheme, and it's entitled How to Help the Crofters. I have a copy of it with me here. As you can see, there's a little sketch of her. Mrs. Gordon Bailey.
In her tartan and her little Tam O'Shanter hat there. The Crofters' Advocate, yes.
Yeah.
When Detective Marshall sees the publicity in the press about this Mrs. Gordon Bailey, a light bulb goes off. He starts to piece things together. He collaborates with two detectives in Edinburgh, and listen to this. An article comes out in February 1888 in the Edinburgh Evening Dispatch. Everything is revealed. The headline is, An Extraordinary Adventuress. Mrs. Gordon Bailey, the Crofter's friend, unmasked.
So this is some wonderful detective work. They've really pieced together all of these different aliases and activities that Mrs. Gordon Bailey had in her life.
So the incriminating news is out. Is this the beginning of the end for Mrs. Annie Gordon Bailey, the Crofter's friend?
Annie's life starts to unravel. She can't overcome her addiction to crime. She's in London, and she's left her kids in a big house she's leased in Broadstairs, Kent. The gas is cut off, and there's no food. And creditors are knocking at the door. It's chaos. The last servant reluctantly goes, abandoning the children, who end up briefly in the workhouse. On the 23rd of June, 1888, 3 months after the newspaper expose, Detective Inspector Henry Marshall and his officers go to Westminster in London to Palmer Lodge, where Annie and Percy are now living with a manservant. They are arrested and accused of receiving goods without paying. And miles away in Skye, the Crofters are still waiting for their golden one-way tickets to Australia. A month later, at a police court hearing, the extent of Annie's fraud is revealed. D.I. Marshall tells the magistrate that her unpaid bills could run into thousands.
Space does not allow here to mention a 50th of the extraordinary and audacious stories of her exploits.
One journalist gets an interview with Annie in the police cells.
I look at this affair in the light of an innocent person, as an injured woman, a maligned woman. Why? When you separate the distinct charges from the clouds of vague, general accusations which have been made in court, what have we?
Annie's case eventually goes to the Old Bailey. She's sentenced to 5 years penal servitude. She's released from prison in 1892, and guess what? She pretty soon begins swindling again. 2 years later, she's in court, charged with stealing paintings. She gets 7 years in prison. Roz, what eventually happened to Annie and her children?
Well, her children, after she was convicted, were sent to the Rose Street Mission House in the Strand. They become a little bit lost. When Annie was released from prison after that second conviction, she emigrated to New York.
Oh.
And appeared again in 1902 in New York under a new alias, Louise J.F. Bailey. And she was sent to the workhouse in New York as a vagrant. And we don't know what happens to her when she was eventually released from that institution.
The workhouse, how the mighty have fallen. Goodness, that's a very sad end to her story. Henry Marshall, by contrast, went on to have a very illustrious career in the Met. Denise, what's your final takeaway from this case?
These people are perennial. They are always there. And whenever there's a very emotive cause, like a charity for childhood cancer, displaced people, these people will always surround those issues like flies. Always do your homework before you give money to charity, because these people are always attracted to this sort of thing.
Roz, what about you?
It exposes this real dark side to charitable giving in the Victorian period, that it wasn't always about helping the unfortunate or supporting worthwhile causes. The case also, of course, shines a torch on petty swindling by women, which was undoubtedly far more prevalent than the criminal records suggest.
Fabulous. I think Annie Gordon Bailey is one of the most audacious and complex characters we've come across in all our crime capers. She's got charisma, and she's clearly addicted to crime. And with the Crofters, Annie's invented a very Victorian swindle. We think of the 19th as being a particularly charitable century, with volunteers and philanthropists doing the jobs that'll later be done by the welfare state. In Annie's lifetime, we get the developing infrastructure with the charity and the appeal, and people adopting the personal branding of being a philanthropist. But as society changes, new opportunities also open up for swindles. When Annie's involved, it turns out that charitable fundraising has a very dark side. Well, a huge thank you to Denise Miner, Roz Crone and Catherine McPhee. Join me next time when a single mother risks her life making counterfeit money at her kitchen table, with horrifying consequences. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Julia Habel, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Jonathan Keeble and Alex Phelps. The historical consultant is Rosalind Crone. The commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts, and the executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with Lady Swindlers weekly on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hi. Hi, we're the Vantulikans, the identical twin Dr. Vantulikans, Chris and Zond. In What's Up, Docs, we're diving into the messy, complicated world of health and well-being. We are living in the middle of what I would call a therapeutic revolution, but it can sometimes be hard to know what's really best for us. Do I need to take a testosterone supplement? How can I fix my creaky knees? Why do I get hangry? Is organic food actually better for me? We're going to be your guides through the confusion. We'll talk to experts in the field and argue about what we've learned and share what we've learned and maybe disagree a fair bit too. No, we won't. What's Up, Docs? From BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.